Welcome to Washington Post Live. I'm David Ignatius, a columnist for the Post. I'm pleased to be joined today by Admiral Rob Bauer, who is the military chair of the Military Committee of NATO. Admiral Bauer, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Good morning, David.
So, Admiral, I want to go right to the drama that's taking place even as we speak. As President Biden delivers an address in Normandy, let's look at what President Biden had to say yesterday when he was at the American Cemetery, that haunting scene where thousands of American graves of the soldiers who fought at D-Day are placed. Let's look at what President Biden said yesterday.
Make no mistake, the autocrats of the world are watching closely to see what happens in Ukraine, to see if we let this illegal aggression go unchecked. We cannot let that happen. To surrender to bullies, to bow down to dictators, is simply unthinkable.
So, Admiral Bauer, I want to ask what your message would be today to the millions of people who are watching President Biden, who are thinking about the NATO alliance. What would you, as chair of the military committee, want to tell people?
I think President Biden is absolutely right in that it is unacceptable if we allow Russia to win in Ukraine. It would have dramatic consequences, not only for Ukraine, but also for the rest of the world, because that is the message, the chilling message to autocratic states that might is right and that you can get away with it. And I think that is something we should not let allow Putin to do. And therefore, we have to continue to support Ukraine with money, with weapons, with ammunition, with training, and everything they need. So, and that is happening now for more than 2 years, which is amazing in itself. But we need to do more, and we need to therefore ramp up our production capacity in our part of the world to make sure those weapons and ammunition are going to be produced faster.
Admiral Bauer, what's your assessment of the situation on the battlefield today? Russia has been pounding Kharkiv, which is the second largest city of Ukraine in the east near the Russian border. Has that offensive slowed? And does Ukraine have the weapons in place it needs to be able to stop Russia from moving further west?
I think the things Russia is doing, they started to be on the offensive again, basically when the support from the West, from the 50 nations that support Ukraine for more than 2 years now, slowed down. The big one was, of course, the $61 billion package from the U.S. But in other nations, there was sort of a downtick as well in terms of the support. So that sort of gave the Russians the idea that there was a window of opportunity, and they started to attack the front again at several places. If you look at the results, it is actually not impressive. They have taken some villages, but it's not strategic militarily at all in terms of the positions they now have. The attack from the north, from Belgorod towards Kharkiv, is actually not feasible with the number of troops that they have. And so again, this is it's all adding up to this, to the picture that the Russians have not achieved any of the strategic goals they wanted to achieve until now. The mighty Russian army has not been able to defeat the much smaller Ukrainian armed forces. It is a war that we're now at the 835th day of a 3 day war, and Ukraine not only prevails, but has been able to take back 50% of what the Russians originally took. They have been able to drive the Russian Navy to the other side of Crimea without a Navy. As a result, they have been able to start the export of grain again without a deal with Putin. And so in many, many ways, so we're talking about more than 350,000 Russian soldiers killed and wounded in this war. So the Russians are not in a good place at all. But of course, it is extremely difficult for the Ukrainians as well. And therefore, we have to continue to support them.
So that's as positive an account as I've heard from a senior official about blunting this Russian offensive that began several months ago. Let me ask about another thing that troubles analysts, and that's Russia's systematic attacks on Ukrainian infrastructure, in particular power. We're just in early summer, but the level of power is already sharply diminished. Many apartment buildings in Kyiv can't keep the lights on parts of the day. And people are deeply worried about what happens when winter comes. What's your assessment of the infrastructure, power, and energy situation in Ukraine? And is there anything that NATO and its member countries can do now so that the winter for Ukrainians won't be a nightmare?
I mean, if you look, traditionally in war, there's always the intent to break the will of the people. And that has been done by attacking the infrastructure, electricity, gas, water, in the beginning of the war. Then for a while, last winter, actually, they didn't. That was fascinating in itself. And then they basically attacked civilian homes. They attacked the houses and apartments of people to break the will of the people. So far, the Russians have not been successful in breaking the will, because this is an existential fight for the Ukrainians. If the Russians stop the war today and go home, pack their gear and go home, then the war is over. If the Ukrainians stop the war today, they have lost their country. So for them, this is an existential fight. They will continue. They tell their president every month, continue the fight, despite all the killing, despite the destruction of infrastructure, despite the hardship as a result of, indeed, no electricity, no water, no heating. And this is not going to be the first winter, the next one, where there's a lot of hardship for the Ukrainian people. So I'm not convinced that Putin will be able to break the will of the Ukrainian people. They're extremely strong people. When I visited them in March, I was visiting Kyiv in March, spoke to the political leadership, to the military leadership, and I'm deeply impressed by how strong that nation is, how they are fighting for their existence. And the Russians don't have a clue what they're fighting for. The Ukrainians do. In terms of how we can support them, I guess the continuous discussions between the 15 nations that support Ukraine and Ukraine is an important venue to hear from the Ukrainians how we can help them best. It's not only weapons and ammunition, but it's, as you say, also in terms of infrastructure, equipment, technology that supports the electricity grid or whatever that is being hit by the Russians. So that is a continuous dialogue, and I'm convinced that we will do everything possible, but that it is difficult is absolutely clear.
Let's talk a moment about escalation. President Biden just last month joined the recommendation of NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg and other European leaders in authorizing Ukraine to use U.S. weapons to strike inside Russia. This was described as limited strikes in terms of range. Make the case for our listeners, if you would, as to why U.S. and NATO weapons should be attacking Russia directly, and how do you evaluate the risks in making that decision?
Well, I would turn it around. Militarily, it is the best thing to do. If you are attacked from a nation that is illegally attacking you, and they start a war, and you are defending yourself, you can do two things. You can wait until the missiles reach you, and then try to kill the arrows, or you kill the archer. And the archer is, in many ways, in Russia. There's aircraft taking off from airfields in Russia. There's the logistic support for the fight in Ukraine from the Russians, which is oil and gas, which is logistics, which is transportation, which is the production of weapons, which is all the things you need in a war. They are being produced and being brought from Russia. So it is the logic thing to do militarily, and it is possible within the law of armed conflict to do that, because the Russians started this war and the Ukrainians are defending themselves. So it is militarily logic. It is within the law possible to do it. And the only discussion for a while between some nations that gave longer range weapon systems to Ukraine and Ukraine has been whether they would allow Ukraine to do that. And I'm happy for Ukraine that that permission is there.
And do you think, Admiral, that there should be limits on the range of those weapons? How far into Russia do you think they should strike, or do you think that should be left to the Ukrainians?
Again, there is in the law on armed conflicts, there's no limits in terms of the range. So militarily, again, if the target is deeper into Russia, then militarily you want to strike that target. If for example, the aircraft that take off from an airfield deeper into Russia. What we've seen with the increasing range that the Ukrainians have been given to strike was that the Russians had to push back, to bring back their logistic nodes. And that, of course, makes it more difficult for the Russians to be successful in the fight. If you have to bring back your logistics from, let's say, 10, 15, 20 kilometers to 50, 100 kilometers, that will make it more cumbersome for the Russians to bring in the logistics. And that helps in the fight. So I think that is the thing you want to do. And if the Russians have to be, if you push back the Russians deeper into Russia, that will make the fight more difficult for them. So and again, this discussion on escalation, we've heard many times that Putin used or other officials used the word red lines when it came to the tanks, when it came to the HIMARS, when it came to the ATACMS. And every time we sort of waited a little bit longer to think about it, and then we gave it. And the result was actually that it wasn't a red line, but the actual result was that the Russians were able to strengthen their defensive works in Ukraine. So in many ways, we have allowed Putin to work on his defense based on him saying it was a red line. And every time we gave the weapon and we used it against him, he's not stupid. So he understands it's within the law and it is militarily logic. Then it wasn't a red line. So we have to be careful not to jump time and time again to this idea that everything is a red line, that everything is an escalation, because first and foremost, Putin has been lying about basically everything. He recently said he would never attack a NATO country. He said to the reporters, "If you think that, you are stupid." Well, he lied about attacking Ukraine. So I think the time is over that we should allow Putin to self-deter us, because that's basically what has happened many, many times.
So in practical terms, Admiral, as you know far better than most, this issue comes down to Putin's threat, specifically by him, by former President Medvedev and others, that Russia's prepared to use tactical nuclear weapons to deal with what it sees as escalation by Ukraine and its NATO supporters. Should NATO ignore those threats? Should it prepare what it would do in the event that Russia did use tactical nuclear weapons? And in that regard, do you think that if Russia was so reckless as to use tactical nuclear weapons, a NATO response to that would be appropriate?
David, let me say one more thing about the question before that. So if a nation still wants to limit anything with regard to the weapons they give to Ukraine, that is their right. I mean, it is a sovereign state that gives away weapons. And if they have concerns with regard to the risks, then it is their right to discuss that with Ukraine. So I'm not questioning that. But if you ask me as a military man what is militarily logic and what is possible within the law of armed conflict, then that was my answer. So I want to be clear on that. With regard to nuclear weapons, there's been a lot of rhetoric. And especially from Medvedev, I think he's getting crazier by the day. But that doesn't make it less dangerous when he says things like we're going to attack whatever nation with nuclear weapons. He's not even only talking about Ukraine, but he's even talking about NATO nations. The quote unquote good news is that so far we haven't seen anything with regard to the nuclear posture of the Russian armed forces that has forced us to change ours. So for now, 2.5 years almost into the war, it is rhetoric. It is dangerous rhetoric. It is dangerous because it sort of becomes normal to talk about nuclear weapons like this. And nuclear war should never be fought and will never be won. So it will change things dramatically if the Russians use it. I'm not going to talk about what NATO is going to do because part of deterrence is that it is not clear necessarily what NATO is going to do. So and it's not useful to talk about what NATO is or isn't going to do. That is for the Russians to be seen.
So fair enough. I'm going to ask you about one more escalation issue. President Macron of France has said that he is ready now to begin training, I believe it's 4,000 Ukrainian troops to send Mirage jets. But he's also talked about the possibility of sending French troops into Ukraine as military advisors. Do you think that's a wise policy? Is that one that other NATO countries might also consider?
Let me start by saying, David, that NATO does not have troops under command of NATO in Ukraine, and there is no plans to do so. So that's very important to start with. Second, if a nation would like to do something like that, send troops to Ukraine, it is not only a issue for that nation and Ukraine. It is a discussion to be had in the alliance as well, because the consequences of an attack on those troops, if it comes to it, is most likely something that NATO is going to get involved in. So in that sense, I think it is extremely important before anything like that would happen, is that there is a discussion amongst political leaders in the alliance. But for now, there is no troops under NATO command, and there is no plans to do so.
So I want to turn to the NATO summit that's coming next month here in Washington, D.C., following an important summit a year ago at Vilnius. The question remains, will be on the table, I'm sure, in Washington, whether there should be some alteration of the timetable or conditions for eventual Ukrainian membership in NATO. What's your view about how this issue should be addressed at this year's NATO summit?
I think it is clear that there will not be a decision on an accession of Ukraine entering NATO, because first and foremost, Ukraine is at war. If we would allow Ukraine in the alliance now, given Article 5, NATO would be at war with Russia. So that is not something we think is wise, and therefore it's not going to happen. And Ukraine knows that. So I think that is not the discussion. The discussion is not going to be a timeline discussion. It's going to be about the conditions. And at the same time, I think it is important for Ukraine And Secretary General Stoltenberg was clear on that. It's not going to be a question on whether Ukraine is going to be a member. It's about when. So I understand the discussion on the timeline, but at the same time, given the fact that I know everybody wants short wars, everybody wants peace, but in the end, there is a war now, and it is a war that has taken now already more than 2 years, and the end of that war is not within. I don't see a very quick end of this war. So we don't know the timelines. What is important, though, is that we show Ukraine that they will become closer to NATO more and more. And that's why we're now working on this mission, which is going to look at four things. One is the coordination of all the training. Second is the coordination of all the things Ukraine needs to make sure that that we talk amongst the allies and find the things that Ukraine needs. And then third is to get it to Ukraine through the logistic nodes. The fourth one is a new one, and that is that we talk about how the Ukrainian armed forces will look like after the war, so the future armed forces of Ukraine. The first three things is things that are being done by the SEGU in Wiesbaden, and the coordination is now being done by the Ukraine Defense Contact Group, organized by the U.S., with 50 nations at the moment. But it is an important signal if those efforts, 50 nations through U.S. helping Ukraine, is going to be coordinated through NATO. That is an important step towards closer cooperation between Ukraine and NATO, bringing Ukraine closer to NATO. That is one. Second, there is going to be a discussion on a more solid, continuous stream of finances for Ukraine, and not a sort of discussion on a monthly basis. Is there more money? Is there more money? If we can make sure that Ukraine knows there is a certain budget per year, then that helps them greatly in organizing themselves through the war and after the war. And then the third element is there is this new joint analysis and training center in Poland that is going to be set up to make sure that we learn the right lessons from the war in Ukraine together with Ukraine and with NATO. So I think those three elements are important signals for Ukraine to make the people in Ukraine understand they will become closer and closer to NATO without an immediate entry into NATO at the Washington summit.
That's a helpful summary of what's ahead here at the summit next month. So we ask our audience for their questions, and I want to read one from Patrick in Illinois who asks, other than Ukraine, where is NATO most concerned there could be another attack on a non-NATO country? What's your thought? We look at Russian statements about Georgia, other activities. Where do you see a potential danger?
Well, the issue is that people focus on the eastern flank and on the nations where, I mean, the Russians are in Georgia. So, I mean, they are not thinking about attacking Georgia. They are in Georgia. They are in Moldova. It's not about attacking Moldova. They are in Moldova since the early 90s. So the Russians are in a number of nations. And of course, these nations where they already are probably a little bit more vulnerable to further invasion than other nations. So that is one. Second, then there is the discussion on what the next target might be, whether it is in NATO or outside NATO. But the Russians are basically everywhere. They are in space, they are in cyber, they are in Africa, where they use the Africa Corps, the former Wagner Group, to destabilize nations. They are in the Arctic, they are in the Atlantic Ocean. So they are everywhere trying to create strategic dilemmas for the alliance. And if there's others, other opponents. And so that is something we will be vigilant on. We have to make sure that we keep on looking 360 degrees in all domains, space, cyber, land, maritime, air, to make sure that we understand what they're doing. And on top of that, there is the disinformation and misinformation and the hybrid actions. The Russians lost a lot of spies because a lot of the allied nations kicked out a lot of so-called diplomats that were spies at the beginning of the full-fledged invasion in Ukraine, and so they were hampered for a longer time in their activities in our part of the world, and they now revert to different types of operation, and that is, for example, hiring local people for money to cause trouble, to set fire to a building, to put a bomb somewhere, or things like that, sabotage actions in general. And then the story, of course, is that if you use a local person in a nation, then you can sort of make the story that that person was against its own nation and is now helping Russia, et cetera, which is nonsense. Of course, they just pay criminals for actions they hope will destabilize our part of the world.
So, Admiral, a question we've had from many viewers, you won't be surprised to hear, is what effect Donald Trump's election in November would have on NATO? He's has a history of sharp criticism of NATO. He's said that if NATO members don't pay up, Russia should go ahead and attack them. As you and your colleagues prepare for a future where we're all uncertain about the outcome, what plans are you making and what worries do you have about that possible change in U.S. leadership?
I think the core of the critique of President Trump was that nations did not invest enough in their own armed forces, and therefore in their ability to defend themselves, which is in line with Article 3 of the treaty. Article 3 says every nation has to be able to defend itself. And we have, a lot of nations in the alliance have neglected that for many, many decades. So I think that critique was right. It is correct that we had to repair that nations had to do more to invest in their armed forces and being able to defend themselves. And I think that is happening now. So at the moment, we see that more and more nations are doing that. We see that more and more nations are going to live up to the new agreement. The agreement in Vilnius is now that at least 2% of the GDP is going to be spent on defense. And the idea is now, or we believe that in Washington, the Secretary General can tell the world that about 2/3 of the alliance now, allied nations, is at that level of 2% or above. And that is a huge increase if you compare it to the time when President Trump was the president. So I think that is the core of the critique, that the U.S. Was paying too much of the bill for too long.
Understood that was his critique. What I'm really asking is, if future President Trump took steps that seemed to undermine NATO, would the alliance push back? In other words, does the alliance care deeply enough about its continuation and strength?
Absolutely.
That it would push
Absolutely.
Back against?
Absolutely. And the Secretary General Stoltenberg has pushed back on the words when President Trump was talking about nations that do not pay up should be attacked by Russia. It's dangerous to talk about it like that, and it is not only dangerous for the nations he was talking about, but it is also dangerous for U.S. soldiers that are now serving around the alliance and in the world if somebody else thinks that you can attack a nation and NATO will not take any measures. So that is in itself dangerous and not helpful at all. But it's not as simple that the U.S. president alone can withdraw from NATO. It's a treaty, and he will require the House, the Congress, and the Senate to actually do that. But of course, talking about it that way is not helpful at all.
So, Admiral Rob Bauer, that's just a extraordinary tour of all of the issues that are facing NATO on a day when we're thinking especially about NATO with this D-Day anniversary. I want to thank you for joining us on Washington Post Live.
It's been a pleasure, David.
So please join us for other programming. If you want to see what we've got coming up, register, subscribe to the Washington Post and our programming and our wonderful news content. Please go to WashingtonPost.com, WashingtonPostLive.com, and see what we've got. Thank you for joining us today. Hope to see you again soon.